out of your very busy schedules to get an important update about an exciting story. We are lucky enough to have Leonard Mazur, chairman of Citius Pharmaceuticals, trades under the ticker symbol CTXR on the NASDAQ, as many of you know. And please just bear with us as the room is filling up quickly and we continue to let individuals into the room. So we're going to allow for, you know, approximately 30 seconds to a minute here to allow everyone to get into the room. And we will have the ability of those folks to ask questions throughout the course of the presentation using the chat feature, and we will have those questions addressed. So as I said, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day. Just give us about another 30 seconds to a minute here, and we will go ahead and get the presentation started. For the new folks that have just entered the room, we are just waiting a short while to allow folks to come in, and then we're going to get started in just a second here. We are conscious of everyone's time and busy schedules, and we are also aware of the very busy schedule for our presenter, our speaker today, who once again is the chairman of Citius Pharmaceuticals, Mr. Leonard Mazur. The company trades under the ticker symbol CTXR on the NASDAQ. You know, we are also lucky enough to have Ray Oliver here from Bear Creek. Ray, maybe you'd like to give us a quick intro to the story, and then we'll allow you to pass the microphone on over to Leonard, and we will get things kicking off.
Sure. Thanks, Todd. Well, you know, I've been working for several years with Citius Pharma, and I've had the luxury to be able to spend some personal time with Leonard, and I have found over the years a man that is very deeply committed to this company. And, you know, there's always a lot of scuttlebutt out there about this and that. But at the end of the day, you know, Leonard and his team is truly committed to moving these assets to the next level. And actually, Todd, Leonard is the CEO and chair of Citius Pharma. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Leonard to tell us all about Citius. Take it away, Leonard.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you, Todd. First of all, again, I just want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us during the course of this presentation. Hopefully, we'll be able to provide you with information that will be useful in making your decision if you haven't made a decision yet about investing in a company. So for full disclosure, what we advise you to do is please consult our either our website, citiuspharma.com, where we have just about every filing, I think, is located there. But you can also go to sec.gov, which is a great website, and type in our symbol, CTXR, for getting all the information that you could possibly want. Is available there. So an informed investor is really the best type of investor. So with that, let me just give you an overview of the company and what we have here. So presently, we are a development stage biopharma company. So we're not realizing revenue yet, but our goal is to get to the revenue stage as quickly as possible. So with that in mind, the very first asset that you see there is IonTac. It has a biological license application filed, BLA, which is equivalent to an NDA if it was a small molecule. This is a protein, so as a result, it's considered to be a biological drug. It's a purified reformulation of an IL-2 diphtheria toxin fusion for cutaneous T cell lymphoma, which is a very rare cancer that's part of the of something known as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's a very small percentage of it's a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So we also have in phase three Mino-Loc, which was our first asset that we started the company with. And this is in phase three at the moment. We're in a process of doing everything we can to get that clinical trial completed so that once it is approved, it would be the first and only FDA-approved drug to salvage infected catheters that are the cause of something known as CLABSI or central line associated bloodstream infections. We also have in phase 2B a hemorrhoid drug, which was a legacy drug that we acquired when we merged in with Citius back a number of years ago. And this one has, again, does have the potential to be the first and only FDA-approved prescription treatment for the treatment of hemorrhoids. What's interesting, in the 21st century, there isn't a single prescription drug approved by the FDA for the treatment of hemorrhoids. You have the over-the-counter side of the market, which has preparation H and products of that type, which comport to the over-the-counter monograph. But on the prescription side, there's nothing there, and it's a giant market with lots of opportunities. So the other assets that we have are all preclinical assets. I'm not going to describe those at the moment because we're really not spending hardly any money on those at this time. Our emphasis is on Minolock and IonTech for the most part. Plus, we spent a smaller amount of funds on the Halo Lido drug. The market opportunities here are substantial. The CTCL market, even though it's a rare disease market, it's at this point about 300 to 400 million and has been growing with each new entry that's come in. That market has shown the potential to take on the entry and grow with each new entry. The CLABSI, CURBSI market, there's nothing there at the moment. We're estimating that market is half of it is in the U.S., 900 million, and the rest of it is outside the U.S., where that problem is a lot worse. The prescription hemorrhoid market, it could be 2 billion, it could be 10 billion. For what anybody knows, what would happen once something like this gets approved. So we've had some major catalysts in 2023 that are occurring. The most important catalyst for us right now is getting an approval from the FDA for IonTAC. The decision date on that is July 28th. The FDA has given us what's known as a PDUFA date. And so that's the day by which they come back to you. They give you an indication of where your application is in terms of approval or other modifications to your work. We in 2023 we will be completing the phase three trial for Minolock. We're not targeting a date; it's somewhere in the course of this year. The Halo Lido phase 2B trial is last patient's already in. Everything's being calculated for a top line data readout, which we're targeting the end of June. So, in terms of financial profile. As of 3/31, which we just recently released, the company has $29 million cash. We also raised capital. We did a $15 million raise, which would be added to that. And something that really separates us out probably from everybody else in this market, and that is that we put our own money on a line here. So this is not money for stock options or anything like that. We invested directly side by side as we did our raises. So I have $22.5 million invested. Myron Holubiak, the co-founder and vice chair of the company, has $4 million invested in the company. So I call this our mugshots. So basically, this is the team. I'm not going to describe my background because I think everybody's heard it enough. I've been in the industry for a fair number of years. My background is a combination of working at mid-sized to large-sized pharma, and then ultimately I went the entrepreneurial route and formed my own company with successful exits. Martin Holubiak, who's our vice chair and co-founder, spent the bulk of his career at Hoffman La Roche, left there after he rose to become vice president of marketing. He really launched all the major antibiotics for them and went off, formed his own company, and then sold his company to Dun & Bradstreet. When he was running that unit for D&B, Roche called him and asked him to come back to the company as president of Roche Labs US, which he served in for a number of years before he and I got together, formed our company. So I'm not going to highlight everybody. Let me just tell you a little bit about Dr. Myron Schwichtman, who we brought on board just about 2 years ago, probably. So Myron's background is really impressive. He's an oncologist. He spent 23 years in practice at Roswell Park in Buffalo, where his expertise was, he was the chief of lymphoma myeloma. He published over 180 papers while he was there. So he's really considered to be a true KOL or key opinion leader. He then left academia and joined Celgene, where he was vice president of global research for lymphoma myeloma as well. When they were acquired by Bristol Myers, he no longer was interested in being part of a large company. He preferred to work in a smaller company where he thought there was significant potential. So he came on board with us. So I also like to draw your attention to Kelly Creighton, who's our EVP of manufacturing and CMC. Kelly has probably worked on more filings related to the manufacturing side than just about anybody. We took him out of Clinipace, which was a consulting company that we were working with, and he came on board with us along with Catherine Kessler, who's EVP of Regulatory Affairs. She was with Clinipace as well and has a strong background on the regulatory affairs side. Nick Berlew also is our EVP of Quality Assurance, and great experience with Clinipace, has great knowledge there. So we have a great team of people on board. I would like to highlight for you that at this point, we're at about 21 people in the company. We have no interns, no training programs. Every person in the company is a professional and highly experienced in their field. So the milestones that we have ahead of us here, as you can see, we've indicated the July 28th date and the importance of that. With respect to Mino-Lok, the Mino-Lok trial, as you'll hear shortly, is an event-driven trial, and we are at 85 to 90 out of 92 required events. So we're very close at this point. We're within probably within 10 percentage points of getting there. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. So we've expanded that trial to India to really bring it across the finish line as quickly as we can. The Halo-Lido trial, it is completed. It's just going through calculations now and putting all the data together. So hopefully we'll see results on that shortly before this quarter is over. So as I indicated to you before, we've got $29 million cash as of 3/31, $15 million through the registered direct offering that just took place a little while ago. That offering, I should highlight for you, is something that I know that I've made comments before about the fact that I don't want to really dilute the company. I have as much a stake as everybody else. I'm the single largest shareholder in the company at the moment, and so for me, our position and what we have as shareholders is really important to us. But also, I recognize that. Given all the financial uncertainty that was going on and has been going on, nobody knows where everything is heading. We don't know if we're going to wake up a month from now and suddenly two banks have failed and there's no money out there. There's nothing. So this opportunity came up with two funds, came in on that raise, one for $10 million, one for $5 million. And I thought we would take that just to give ourselves a little bit more dry powder. So with that, we have a cash runway going through May 2024. And we've indicated that The plan is to take IonTech and place it into a spin-off company that would be a cancer company. And we're working with the financial advisors at the moment, advancing that process through. That really cannot take place until the process for it can't take place until IonTech is approved. So after that, everything within would start to accelerate as far as that whole spin-off process. So let me start with and start this with Minilock, which is the antibiotic lock solution that we licensed from MD Anderson. Why we like this drug is the fact that there's nothing else in the market for it at the moment. So there are 7 million, as you can see, central venous catheters inserted annually in the United States. 4 million of them are long-term. And most of those long-term patients that have these central venous catheters inserted are cancer patients. And so this the central venous catheter really becomes a lifeline for these patients because it brings nutrients, it brings chemo, it brings other types of therapeutics that treatment that that they're going to require. The difficulty is that somewhere around 500,000, close to 500,000 of those 4 million long-term catheters get infected. And when they get infected, the only standard of care today is to remove that catheter and replace it, which requires two separate surgical procedures. So what most people don't realize is that that catheter is, the way it's inserted, it gets initially inserted into by the collarbone area, and it's threaded to the heart, to the superior vena cava. So, and if it gets infected, what occurs is that catheter has to be it has to be removed surgically because it was surgically implanted, and then it has to be a new site has to be found for it. A lot of times, what will happen is the catheter will be a new catheter will be placed by the groin area and threaded back up to that superior vena cava, causing complications, thrombotic and mechanical. There's a high rate of discomfort and adverse physical and psychological symptoms that can arise from that, as well as there's about an 18 to 20% serious adverse event profile associated with remove and replace. Also, there's a cost that we're estimating maybe a little bit higher in some places of $10,000 to do both of those procedures. And the cost of an overall episode of this is anywhere, depending on a hospital, $45,000 to $65,000. It's a very serious issue when that catheter gets infected for these patients. Some of these patients can actually die as a result of having an infected catheter. So, so what we have is as you saw before, it's simple to administer because the nurse will come in and inject that catheter, inject the solution into the catheter. The catheter itself gets locked, so the solution does not go into man. It does not enter into the human body at all. So the catheter gets locked. It's the solution stays there for for up to 2 hours. At the end of 2 hours, the nurse will come in, aspirate out the contents, and flush the line, and the patient then has 22 hours of uninterrupted IV flow, which is really critical. One of the challenges that the inventor had of this, his name is Dr. Isam Rad out of MD Anderson, was he had to come up with something that could be administered in a short period of time and not compromise the IV flow. So he finally hit on it with that special combination of three ingredients, namely an antibiotic, minocycline, sodium EDTA as a chelating agent, and alcohol. So once that was once he figured all that out and he ran his tests, he found that this was the a solution that really, really worked well that nobody had been able to do before. and he filed a patent for it. And ultimately, we licensed this technology from MD Anderson. So we ourselves, myself and Myron, we had a private company at this point, and we funded all the phase 2B work to get that completed. The phase 2B trials, you can see the data here. It was a comparison of the Mino-Lok treatment arm to a remove and replace arm. And all types of cancers, whether they were solid tumors or blood cancers, bacteria that was gram positive, gram negative, all this was included in that trial. And as you can see here, we had 100% effectiveness in the sense that we had no side effects, no complications, nothing, no serious adverse events related to this, as opposed to about an overall adverse event profile of 18% for the remove and replace arm. So with that, what we did, we went to the FDA, we submitted our data. After a period of time, we worked out a protocol with them. The protocol was to compare the Mino-Lok solution to what I call a homebrew. And that is, it's a solution that the hospital mixes up. And what happens in certain cases, when a patient, they're not able to do a remove and replace because there are no more access points left, they will try a mixing their own antibiotic mixture to see if they can't salvage that catheter. So that's the comparison arm that we have here. The endpoint is time to catheter failure, which is the event. It's a failure event. So the trial lasts about 6 weeks, and then we analyze the data after that point. So we have clinical sites both. We started here in the U.S., and the reality of it is that this trial would have been complete and over, and we would have been approved by now in all likelihood if it hadn't been for COVID. COVID came along and really stopped us in our tracks. The reason being is because most of the trial was administered in hospitals, and I don't have to tell any of you what happened in the hospitals over this 3-year period. Nobody was getting into the hospitals, nobody. So, and that included anybody doing clinical research or anything like that. So, consequently, what we decided to do is to after examining our alternatives, to go to India, where this problem is significant, and we'll be finishing up the trial, even though we'll start getting some data in from here on the U.S. side, but the bulk of the data that remains is going to be coming out of India. So what we like about this drug also is the fact that the FDA was really impressed with this, and they recommended that we file for something called QIDP, or Qualified Infectious Disease Product. It's a special status that's given to just for antibiotics only, that are considered to be breakthrough. And the review time for when you file your new drug application is reduced from 12 to 6 months. Like most people probably don't realize this, but when you have a drug and you submit your approval, just like we did on the BLA for Iontac, that review time is 12 months normally. And here with this, because again, they consider these to be breakthroughs, they want to get them on the market quickly, they reduce the review time in half to 6 months. Most critically, and which we really like about this, is that we get 5 additional years of market exclusivity. So here what happens is most drugs, when they're approved, they'll get 3 to 5 years, depending, of market exclusivity under the Hatch-Waxman Act. With this adds another 5 years on top. So this means that no one, no generic, nobody can come in. You can't get hit with something known as paragraph 4 or anything like that. You have regulatory exclusivity is about the best way I can describe it. So we'll have somewhere between 9 and 10 years is our estimate once this is approved. And that's going to give it'll give the drug a lot of value at that point in the marketplace. We also have fast track and also supplementary protection in Europe, where we get the patent protection extended for up to 5 years. So with that, I'll move into IonTAC or EQUAT 7. We have various nomenclatures for this. This drug has some history to it, in a sense that, I'll give you our history, and that is that we acquired this the license to this from Dr. Reddy's Laboratories, and it was an Eisai license. So we have a license with Eisai Pharmaceuticals, a big Japanese company that acquired this drug a number of years ago from Ligand. Ligand was the original developer. And we closed the transaction towards the end of September of 21. We were very confident about this drug because of the fact that, number one, it was on its very last patient when we completed that license, when we acquired that license. So we knew that this was heading towards fast completion and that we would be BLA fileable. As you can see, last patient in was December 21. September of 22, we submitted the BLA, and then the FDA has 60 days to respond. They came back in November, told us that we had a July 23 PDUFA date. So those are the standards that the timeline that you see here. So we expect that our launch will take place somewhere in 24. So what is cutaneous T-cell lymphoma? It's a disease that starts out really as a dermatological disorder. So a lot of times, as you can see, it's at the, when it's in the plaque stage, most of the time, the dermatologist is treating this with a variety of different topicals, mostly, and may include phototherapy as well. And it's more prevalent in men than women, and usually appears in patients in their 50s and 60s. As I indicated before, it's a part of, it's a very small part of something known as non-Hodgkin lymphoma, which covers about 80-some other lymphomas, for those of you that are curious about that. So when this drug, when the disease itself moves into the tumor phase, that's when it will become the province of the oncologist. So the history here is this. Prior to us, and we should explain this to you, but prior to our getting the license, what happened here was Eisai was the one that acquired it from Ligand. It got approved. It was on the market for 3 years. And what happened was that as part of their the approval from the FDA, the company, as a phase four requirement, was required to reformulate the drug. And they had to remove some unfolded proteins. There were no side effect issues or anything like that. And this drug is very hard to make. And the company had, at that point, a low amount of inventory. So they decided to, they had to make a choice. Either they kept selling it and could do nothing with it, or they had to pull the drug off the market so they could use the inventory to do the reformulation work. When they took the drug off the market, they reformulated the drug. They came back to the agency. The FDA said, thank you very much, but you have a new drug here, and so you got to do another phase three trial for this, which is what they did. So, that phase three trial was difficult to complete. They started it somewhere in 2014. It took all this time, and the reason for a very low number of patients. COVID didn't help either in terms of the situation. So here we are in 2023, just about 9 years later, and this drug is getting finally approved. So, but the history on it, will work in our favor. It's an orphan indication, small market. What we like about it is that the prescriber base is really small. There are only about 5,000 oncologists in the whole entire United States. And out of that, the number of prescribers for this are even smaller. We think we do have some good protection here in terms of as far as market exclusivity, and it is a very complex manufacturing process and expensive to initiate. So the upside potential here is that we can expand this indication ultimately into something known as peripheral T-cell lymphoma, which is a larger indication. And we can we already have something known as investigator-initiated IND trials with using our drug combined with the Keytruda and also with CAR T. So the mechanism of action we have is differentiated from anybody in the marketplace. The drug itself targets malignant cells by binding to IL-2 receptors to deliver a diphtheria toxin, killing the tumor cells directly. It eliminates immunosuppressive Tregs by reducing them, subsequently enhancing anti-tumor immunity. So there is competition in that market, as you can see. Seagen has the leading product in the market called Adcetris. Kyo Kirin, which is a Japanese company, has Podoligo. So these two drugs, Bristol Myers has more or less backed off this drug because they had other larger priorities. So the two primary competitors are Seagen and Kyo Kirin. And we think we have advantages against them. But at the same time, what we know in terms of our surveying of the market, and we've seen how these drugs behave when they were introduced. So this market segment, when ONTAC had it to itself, was about a $30 million segment. So as each entry came in, it added to the overall size of the market. So the market right now is $300 to $400 million split among these entities. So we think there are some really good growth drivers here. We think we can penetrate this market with a small number of sales folks. Most likely will be using medical service liaison reps. We like the fact that it's an add-on type of market that basically will be added to the existing treatments that are in that market. So the clinical trial that I spoke about, actually, it was there was a lead-in study of 21 patients, and then the main study itself was 71 patients with stage 1 through 4 CTCL. We submitted the data to the FDA, and as you can see here, we had an overall objective response rate of 36.2%. Nearly half the patients on the trial experienced a complete or partial response and or stabilized their disease. So what also is a plus here is that the skin burden itself was reduced as far as in about one third of the patients. And also we had a rapid response time to the patients that were on the trial that got 1.4 months and a durable response, meaning that the disease was controlled among patients who responded for 6.5 months. There were no new safety signals. What I should also point out before I get into that is what everybody should be aware of is that none of these entities cure. So all that the oncologist is trying to do is extend that patient's life cycle and lifespan. So we had no evidence of cumulative toxicity. It was very low grade in terms of low numbers of side effects, as you can see here. Capillary leak syndrome being the highest one at 5.8%, and an infusion reaction, which you'll see most of the time once this is being infused, you'll see that in any drug study. So as I indicated before, that the upside potential here is PTCL, but that PTCL indication has already been approved in Japan by Eisai. And we would require a clinical trial to get to expand that potential. We're going to be examining that, but also we have these two investigator-initiated trials with IONTAC combined with Keytruda or IONTAC combined with CAR T cell therapy. So what's happening? Give me an example here. In the University of Pittsburgh trial, which is the Keytruda one, what the investigator is looking at is he's taking the Keytruda failures, those that have failed on Keytruda. This is not CTCL. It can be any indication that they're studying. And the patients that have failed on it are also administered IonTAC to see if there's been any material benefit as a result. So I can't predict what the outcome of this is. So we're supporting that study, those two studies. And if there is any sign of any positive activity, the plan would be then to expand that trial to other centers around the country. So with that, I'd like to move into Halo-Lido, which is, for those of you that don't know the history of this, this drug came to us really, it's a legacy drug. We were private, we merged in with Citius, which was public. This drug was inside of Citius at the time. We almost didn't keep it, but then after looking at what the market itself looked like, we decided to go ahead with it. Ultimately, we wound up with a formulation that is a very high potency steroid known as halobetazole, combined with lidocaine. So we've had, formulated a drug. We're getting a patent on it. We've applied for patent protection on it because it has a unique delivery system. And the phase 2B trial has been completed. So it's undergoing now all the statistical gathering of everything and calculating everything. It was 300 patients, five arms. The primary endpoint was a reduction in hemorrhoid symptoms. We used a self-reporting questionnaire where the patients had, the subjects had either a laptop or not a laptop, but an iPad or their cell phone, which and they could enter in the data daily as they completed the trial. So we're expecting that top line data readout at the end of this at the end of this half. As I indicated before, the potential here is tremendous because there are more than 10 million patient visits probably or thereabouts in the United States for this. And the only thing that's available for these patients are some older drugs that are a combination of lidocaine and hydrocortisone, which is a very weak steroid. So with that, let me summarize indicate, show you basically here the catalyst that we see on the horizon. I've indicated these before. So the first one up will be the Halo-Lido trial at the end of, targeted for the end of June. The Mino-Loc phase 3 completion is here. I'm not going to predict any date for you here, except that we're shooting for 2023. We'll have the spinoff of the standalone oncology company, as well as that PDUFA date of 7/28, which is really important for the company. In terms of the financial profile, the overview on the company is that presently we have 146.2 million shares outstanding. I'm looking at the wrong chart. 158 million shares outstanding. And with that fully diluted 219 million shares outstanding, as I indicated before, 29 million cash plus the 15 million that we raised, along with the fact that our own money's in, and myself and Myron Holubiak are significant shareholders in the company. So with that, I'll open the floor now for some questions.
Leonard, thank you very much for that very detailed overview of the company. And yes, we do have a number of questions that have come in here. And of course, you know, there are a few, and we should get right into it to address, you know, some of the recent funding that was done. One question about the share offering in front of, you know, three catalysts. And, you know, I know that you had suggested that this was in a way of being able to achieve some additional dry powder and making sure that you have the runway. Just talk us around that thought a little bit, you know, in doing so right now, rather than having waited until some of these catalysts come in, and what was some of the purpose behind it?
Well, those catalysts have a certain amount of risk associated with that. So basically, you do your own risk assessment of the future, and you're not 100% sure about those catalysts. So it would be great if we knew 100% that they were coming through. And obviously, we took that into consideration. We didn't think that this was a major raise. $15 million was not a major raise. And the overall dilution was not that impactful. So overall, on a net basis, it was somewhere around 8%. So we decided to, and the fact was that we had two large investors that came in. And subsequently, we thought that we did the right thing for the company. It's we're stewards of the company, and it's important for us to manage the company for the benefit of the shareholders, but also we want to make sure that the company is on solid financial footing all the time.
Yeah, well, fair enough too. I mean, look, I don't want to get political on this call, certainly not. I know that, you know, from a political standpoint, there's been obviously talks about a default of a debt ceiling, potentially on the horizon, and more indicators that come out about, you know, the potential fears of greater recessionary environments. So being opportunistic in this way and getting the capital when it was available, you know, certainly, you know, I understand the strength, of a positioning that puts the company in.
So Todd, it's like this. We have all experienced an ever-changing world, and that world has been changing dramatically on us.
No doubt.
Events are now overnight. They're not happening over extended periods of time. They're overnight. Overnight. Look what happened when the Silicon Valley Bank went, the way people pulled money out of that bank, and any rumors, anything like that. And I've lived it before. I think some of us have. We've seen when all of a sudden things just dry up and they're no longer there.
Yeah.
So we got
and that's part of take all that I'm alluding to as well. You know, right. you suggested, you know, obviously greater uncertainties that are occurring, and you know, being opportunistic and taking advantage, you know, of the environment. You know, like I said, I assume that those are a lot of some of the things that went into that overall decision. So
if I can jump in for one second,
sure.
Todd, I just wanted to say this. You know, we also went through this when COVID came. I mean, COVID was very unforeseen for a lot of us. And if a lot of people who have been shareholders remember, Leonard took in a lot of money during that time, which was controversial back then. I mean, a lot of people did not like it. And, you know, here we are with a phase three asset that has a PDUFA date. You know, regardless of how you feel one way or another about the dilution, I mean, certainly you can look at this event maybe in almost the same light as that last one. Leonard, maybe you want to touch on that.
So I agree with what you're saying, Ray. I think that, every time we have raised capital, we've taken a lot of heat for it. But I think, again, my duty is to the shareholders and also to ensuring that the company is on a solid financial footing. So that's, I'll repeat that again. Tell her to go out there. I think they're out there.
Yeah. So, you know, Leonard, let's talk about, I mean, obviously being opportunistic and now having this capital. And there are a number of questions that have come in and around this, and I'll kind of, you know, make it in conjunction with each other, because, you know, some of what now this means as it relates to the cash flow runway that the company has on the balance sheet. And in conjunction, part of the questions are coming in about the payout that may be required for Dr. Reedy as it relates, to the INTAC. So, you know, talk to us about, you know, that and how that relates to the runway.
Okay, so basically, our plan is, as I've indicated, that we will take IonTac. The IonTac it's in a subsidiary of the company, and the plan is to spin off that subsidiary. So in a separate public company ultimately. That's going to take some time to get there for it to be public, but we're working on a mechanism for that now as we speak. So right now, the runway we have, it's a combination of, I got an urgent call here that I just must take. So can you bear with me, and I'm going to mute it, or mute me if you could. Okay. Thank you.
So, yeah, guys, bear with us here. Obviously, you know, Leonard, dealing just with, you know, these are the tasks and responsibilities of CEOs and chairmen, but we'll be back with us in just one second here. And I know that we've got, you know, a few additional questions that we are planning to address. One thing that I do want to let everyone know on the call is that we will also be circulating copies of the deck once the call concludes to everyone on this and make sure that you all get updates. But Leonard, it sounds like you're back with us. So what we were addressing right now was the overall, you know, runway and as it relates to the spinoff. So you know, as part of that, you know, the spinoff with this new company and as it relates to that going public, will the responsibility of the approval of Iantac fall on Sidious, or will that fall on the new co?
As far as the launch of it and everything goes, that will be in the new co.
Got it.
So those operating expenses will accrue to the new co.
Got it.
So that's the game plan that we have moving ahead. So we are going to put we're going to be the company will be the majority owners or 100% owners starting out of the new co. As we bring in investment funds for that new co, that'll decrease somewhat. We also are presently examining how to do some distribution of those shares in a new co to the city as shareholders. So that's also being worked on at this point. I don't have any up to the minute details on that, but I'm sure there are a lot of questions about it. But when we get everything spelled out, the way it's all going to be organized and set up, we will most definitely inform all our shareholders how we plan to approach that. Hopefully that answered some of those questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Changing gears a little bit then here, we've had a number of questions that have come in as it relates to Halo Lido. One of the question is surrounding, your mentions in the past about not taking that through phase 3 trials. Is that still the plan? Do you plan on selling the rights after the completion of phase 2? Or is there anything that you can, inform us about what are the latest intentions?
So basically, obviously, we can't plan for anything until we know what that data looks like. That's a real key to it. So if the data is positive, our plan is to see if we can't monetize the asset by either out-licensing it or selling it to a major or mid-sized pharma company. That's we've always stated that as being our plan for the drug. But again, as I've highlighted here, it all depends on the outcome of that trial. So which at this moment, since it's all blinded, nobody has any insight into it.
Okay. You know, I know that we had a specific question with maybe a little bit more, you know, information that wanted to be presented by one of our esteemed attendees here. Poe, were you able to access your microphone? We can. Thank you, Bill. Yeah, so and Leonard, I think that just part of the question was just to talk to us shareholders about, you know, some of the reasons, you know, because we've got obviously loyal shareholders in this thing, you know, why we should continue to remain committed and what you're planning on executing for us.
We have catalysts here. I think the catalysts are strong catalysts, positive catalysts. So I think our shareholders, because they believe in what the company's future is going to materialize to. So we've got very positive catalysts ahead of us. So I wouldn't put $22.5 million in a company if I didn't believe that down the road here that we were going to have a real positive outcome for everybody. So, I think those three that we have right now, they're three shots on goal. So for all of us, they're critical, and we're very I'm an optimist by personality, so otherwise I wouldn't be doing all this. So as a result, I have strong belief, along with the rest of the company. All of us are very committed to delivering. So and that's what we plan to do, and that's why I think everybody should stick with us, and we'll get through this together in a positive way.
Leonard, I'd like to jump in for a second, you know, and Todd can probably relate to this too. I remember a time when we were running around with you and you had probably a sub $50 million market cap and didn't have half the assets that you have on your balance sheet. And you have managed to successfully move those assets just about to the finish line. And, you know, again, I know people get caught up in dilution and it seems like all the time that people are trying to pin you down on timetables and everything else. And it's a lot to manage. But at the end of the day, I think it's really important for people to understand that that you're doing you're working your heart out. And I know it because I'm with you. I see you, and I know the late nights and the thankless trips and everything else that we've done to get in front of the right audiences. Heck, I remember a time where we were in front of four people, and one of those people decided to put $1 million into your stock based on you talking about the company. So, you know, we're all with you, brother. You keep doing what you're doing. Make sure that we're well financed. Make sure that we're moving these assets down the field. And, you know, again, it's been an honor and a pleasure to be around you all the time.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Rick. Thank you very much. And I do I appreciate all of our shareholders. I want them to know this, that I know it's sometimes it's not easy as you go through the ups and downs. And it's something that I more or less have learned to live with it, but it's not, I know it's not easy if you're a shareholder on the outside, not privy to every single little piece of information, et cetera, except all that can be publicly disclosed. It's not an easy place to be, but I do appreciate your loyalty and support. So, and I thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and we appreciate you, Leonard, and all that you do. And we appreciate everyone for taking the time out of your busy day and you know, for your commitment to the company, obviously, with a lot of different options out there in the investment space. And we will certainly plan on keeping everyone updated again and regularly. And until our next presentation, we will make sure and have everyone on the email distribution list and getting everyone a copy of the deck as well. But once again, Leonard, really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day. Ray, and for everyone that participated on today's call, that we will do this again soon, and we hope to have everyone back.
Okay, thank you.
Keep on driving, Leonard. Keep on driving.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks again, everyone. Poe, thank you for the great question. And for everyone else, we will see you again soon.
Bye-bye.